From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. After the success of Mona Lisa, Irish filmmaker Neil Jordan went to Hollywood and made two movies. One of them starred Robert De Niro and Sean Penn. On this edition of Fresh Air, Jordan tells us why he left Hollywood to go back home, back to a small budget and the kind of personal film he used to make. Also today, we get an inside look at the state of women's sports in America with athlete and sports journalist Mariah Burton Nelson. And we have reviews of the new album from Elvis Costello and the new book from Don DeLillo. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The German parliament today voted narrowly to move the seat of German government from Bonn to Berlin. The move will cost billions of dollars, bringing thousands of jobs to Berlin, but eliminating them in Bonn. More from NPR's Tom Jelton.
The supporters of Bonn remaining the seat of German government had a slight majority, but more than 10 hours of parliamentary debate over the question apparently changed some minds. In the end, Berlin won over Bonn by a vote of 337 to 320. According to the final proposal, the German parliament, the Bundestag, and the ministries will both move to Berlin, though the upper house of parliament, the Bundesrat, will remain in Bonn along with numerous government offices. Chancellor Helmut Kohl and Foreign Minister Hans-Dietrich Genscher both spoke out strongly in favor of Berlin as the capital of Germany during the debate today, saying the once divided, now unified city is the symbol of the new Germany. Bonn advocates argued that the move to Berlin would be too expensive, especially considering the high costs unification has already brought here. I'm Tom Jelton in Berlin.
A congressional report released today says that despite President Bush's call for restraint in the Middle Eastern arms trade, his administration has proposed billions of dollars in weapons sales. The report was prepared by the Congressional Office of Technology Assessment. It was released by Democratic senators who've introduced a bill that would require the president to seek an international agreement to limit weapon sales in the Middle East. Although the president has called for self-restraint among arms-producing nations, the report said the administration has proposed more than $26 billion in weapon sales to Middle Eastern countries. The Supreme Court ruled today that judicial elections are covered by the Voting Rights Act and that states must draw judicial districts for elections to protect minorities from discrimination under that act. The court's decision came in two cases, one from Louisiana and one from Texas. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
In Louisiana, the state Supreme Court consists of seven members. Five are elected from single geographical districts, but the two from the greater New Orleans area are elected at large from a multi-member district. The practical consequence of this system is that the majority black residents of New Orleans are outnumbered by the white residents in the city and the surrounding areas, and no minority has been elected to the state Supreme Court. The black residents sued, claiming the system violates the Federal Voting Rights Act. But the lower court said the Voting Rights Act applies to legislatures and the executive, but not to the judiciary. Today, the Supreme Court, by a 6-3 vote, disagreed, ruling that the Voting Rights Act does cover judicial elections and that Louisiana must redraw its judicial districts to avoid discriminating against blacks. I'm Nina Totenberg at the Supreme Court.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrials lost just over a point to close at 2,953. This is NPR. Researchers from San Francisco reported today that programs to supply drug addicts with clean hypodermic needles haven't encouraged drug taking. The needle exchange programs are designed to help prevent the transmission of the AIDS virus among intravenous drug users. Critics claim that they simply increase the amount of drug abuse. At the International AIDS Conference in Italy today, researchers said that drug users who came to needle exchange programs were far less likely to share needles. House Democratic Whip William Gray, the most powerful black member of Congress, announced today that he'll quit politics. The 49-year-old Pennsylvania representative is resigning to become president of the United Negro College Fund. Joe Richman reports from New York.
William Gray has served in Congress since 1978 and is the third highest-ranking Democrat in the House. Speaking at a press conference today in New York City, Gray cited family and financial considerations for his decision and said that rather than wait around for years to move up the ranks in Congress, he could have a larger impact outside of politics.
The most important thing that Bill Gray could do with the remaining time that he has left in his career is to make sure that in the next generation there will be a set of leaders who will lead this country and, yes, go further, faster, and higher than Bill Gray.
As president of the United Negro College Fund, Gray will lead the largest black fundraising organization in the U.S. For National Public Radio, I'm Joe Richman in New York.
The Pentagon said today that the United States and its allies are discussing the possibility of leaving some troops in northern Iraq to protect Kurdish people in the region. Spokesman Pete Williams refused to comment on reports that the United States has agreed to extend the deadline for the withdrawal of its troops. The report said that allied troops might be left behind to ensure a smooth transition to a security force for the Kurds. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. You'd expect a movie director to want to keep making bigger movies, and that's the direction screenwriter and director Neil Jordan was headed in. He started off making small personal films in Ireland and England, movies most people have never heard of, like Danny Boy and The Company of Wolves. Then he made the 1986 film Mona Lisa, which starred Bob Hoskins as a small-time mobster and Michael Caine as his boss. That film's success opened the door to Hollywood and bigger budgets. But his 1988 comedy, High Spirits, was a critical and commercial bomb. In 1990, he directed a remake of We're No Angels with Robert De Niro and Sean Penn. It was a much better experience for Jordan, and it was the first time he directed someone else's script. But that someone else was David Mamet, and Jordan says he loved the screenplay. Nevertheless, he wanted to make a personal film again with his own script. So Jordan returned home to Ireland and made a low-budget movie called The Miracle, which is about to open in the U.S.
I'd made two big movies and I was rather tired. And I wanted to be in a situation where I could... The problem with working as a director is one tends to do bigger and bigger and bigger things, you know, particularly a European director who has some success in America and goes there and stuff like that. And I just wanted to make sure I was able to make a film that would cost $6 or $7 million as well as one that would cost 20 or 30, which is, it's actually a rather difficult decision to make sometimes.
Were there things that you didn't like about your more Hollywood movie experience, things that got out of control because of the number of executives and so on who are in on it?
Yeah, well, I mean, High Spirits was recut without... You know, really, it was recut in spite of me in many ways, and so that I lost control of that film, really. I lost control of the final cut of the movie, and that was a rather unhappy experience for me. We're No Angels was... I was quite happy with the my relationship with the studio on that film. They were very good. They were very professional and very supportive of me throughout it. It was obviously a large-budget American movie, and I suppose it had a kind of a stylistic, a kind of a narrative shape to it, which I normally wouldn't engage in myself. But apart from that, it was a rather good experience.
When you say you lost control of High Spirits, what does it mean when you lose control and when you can't have the final edit? How was the movie changed by that?
Well, what happens is movies are changed during previews, really. And if yourself and the producers don't see eye to eye, you know, the film is previewed, maybe the cards are bad, there's pressure on you to recut the movie, you trim it a little bit, do a few little things, and they preview it again, and gradually just the film just gets shorter and shorter and noisier and generally worse and worse. I mean, that's what happens in that kind of situation. That's what happened with High Spirits.
When you say the cards are bad, you mean the little cards that the viewers
the
have to fill
just,
out to evaluate what
yeah,
they just saw at the screening?
Yeah, it's kind of garbage, really, but it's what everybody seems to do these days, you know. It's those kind of previews can be used as a weapon to really to wrest control of the movie from your hands. Really, that's what I found in that experience with High Spirits.
Is it used also to prove, like, well, look, you're wrong? I mean, you can't
Absolutely,
argue
yeah,
with the audience.
Of course. Yeah. And generally, I suppose it often happens when both yourselves and your producers would have different intentions in the first place. You know, I mean, the American producer of that movie wanted a kind of a noisy, stupid comedy, that was aimed, I suppose, at a teenage audience. I wanted to make something that had a bit more shape and wit to it, and because I had radically different needs and intentions than they had, the film kind of gets mangled in between it.
What do you do to disassociate yourself from a movie? Like, when the movie came out, you weren't willing to say this kind of thing, were you?
Oh, I did say it when it came out, yeah, I did. I did. But it's a difficult thing because you still like your work, you know, and you still, you don't fully lose affection for it. You don't lose affection for it. It's just like it's a difficult thing emotionally to cope with. It's really, the experience for me was the experience of not being allowed to finish a piece of work that I had embarked upon.
Mm-hmm.
And that was most distressing.
Neil Jordan, let me ask you to describe in your own words what your new movie, The Miracle, is about.
It's a story about a ruptured family. It's a story about adolescence. It's basically using the kind of Oedipal myth or, you know, kind of legend to illuminate the lives of two young adolescents and a boy's parents. It's kind of a Oedipal tragicomedy, I would call it.
It's set in a small beach town just south of Dublin, and a 17-year-old girl and boy think that everyone in the town is remarkably dull.
Yeah.
And they try to make life more interesting by playing a game where they make up a life or a secret past for everyone they meet.
Yes.
And then they meet this beautiful and truly mysterious older woman.
Yes.
Who the young boy falls in love with.
Yes.
And that's where the Oedipal stuff comes in. Am I giving away too much if I explain who she is? Would you rather I didn't do that?
Well, I don't know. I don't know, really. Maybe you shouldn't.
Okay. Did you play this kind of game that the two 17-year-olds play of trying to make up a story for everybody in the town?
Yeah, well, I mean, I still do that. You know, I look at people on tubes, I look at people in the street, and I like to make up histories for them. It's a kind of thing a novelist does or a writer does. I put myself into that movie in the shape of these two adolescents in a way. I mean, when I was that age, about 15, 16, I used to write in a copybook all the time. You know, I used to kind of try and invent rather grand fictions for myself to be involved in, you know, and, you know, try to see the world, the rather drab world around me in a very, you know, alluring and melodramatic light. So that's, I suppose that it does reflect that the kind of adolescence I had, yeah.
My favorite line that they write is, this is about a man in a small restaurant. They think he's really dull, so one of them is writing this: nothing of any conceivable interest has ever happened to him. The drabness of his life was so complete as to have its own fascination. it's wonderful, you know, very pretentious and really terrific.
Yeah, pretentious and
yeah.
But that actually is a line I wrote that was to be the beginning of a short story. You know, I mean, it was a great pleasure doing this film actually because I suppose the girl Rose in particular is a writer manque and. You know, one can put all sorts of bits, odds and ends that one has never actually written and finished into a character like that.
Was that a story? How old were you when you wrote that?
Oh, I was probably 38, probably last year.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
The young leads in your movie are, I think, both 17 years old. Were they professional actors? How did you find them?
Well, they'd never acted before, and I consciously tried to find two kids who had never acted before because I don't like teenage or child actors. I feel they learn all the wrong habits and whatever, you know, whatever spark or whatever instinct there is in a young person is generally destroyed by the process or the training that people go through when they go to acting schools and stuff like that. So I just, with the casting director, saw about 2,000, you know, maybe about 600 kids and went through them until we found the right pair. It was particularly difficult because I had given these kids language to speak. You know, I'd given them real language. It's very often the way you see adolescents portrayed in movies, and they can be very effectively portrayed when they're inarticulate and, you know, speak in monosyllables and, you know, kind of grunts and stuff like that. But I wanted these two characters to speak, you know, and I wanted them to use words that were too big for them to understand, you know, and to be exploring their imaginations through language. So the danger was that it could seem terribly arch or pretentious if the wrong people had actually been cast, you know. And when I did try test a few actors, I found, like, the lines came out as dreadfully arch. So I decided to go the opposite way to get people who are two kids who are actually quite raw and quite inexperienced.
What kind of advice do you give young actors who haven't acted, especially when you're so skeptical of the typical type of professional acting training that they get?
When I'm directing them, you mean?
Yeah.
You would direct them as you would ordinary actors, you know? They would need a little bit more space. They would be more unpredictable. They wouldn't know how to hit marks. They wouldn't know how to, they wouldn't know how to repeat things, repeat, you know, gestures or emotional moments the way actors can do. But you have to kind of catch the moment for, you know, as a director, you have to catch, you know, you have to kind of grasp the moment in a far more immediate way because it won't be repeated. But in general, I would, you know, I'd treat them the same way as I treat actors, you know, by asking them to inhabit the character and to reimagine it for themselves.
In your movie, both father and son are saxophonists.
Yeah.
And they play some great classic tunes like Stardust, but also some classic kitsch like Cuando Cuando and Hernando's Hideaway. Did you have to play songs like that when you were a young
musician?
When
I was a kid, yeah, I did. Yeah, I used to play it with my father, yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
What kind of... Did he play dances?
Yeah, he played the violin. He played a lot of instruments, so he used to. He didn't play dances. Not commercially, you know, professionally. No, but I used to play music with him quite a bit. And, that thing of a father and son, and the main thing they have in common being not an inability to speak, or an ability to speak only perhaps through music, is a thing that I've put into quite a few of the stories I've written in the past.
If you're just joining us, my guest is screenwriter and director Neil Jordan. And his movies include Mona Lisa, High Spirits, We're No Angel, which was written by David Mamet and starred Robert De Niro and Sean Penn. And now he has a new movie. He's returned to Ireland to make it, and it's called The Miracle. We'll take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Irish screenwriter and director Neil Jordan is my guest, and his new movie is called The Miracle. Now, this movie is set in a small beach town south of Dublin called Bray. That's where you're living now?
That's where I live, yeah.
Is that where you grew up also?
I grew up sometime there when I was a kid. I was there for about... My mother grew up there, her mother, her grandmother, great-grandmother, and stuff like that. So it's kind of a family home in a way, I suppose you could call it. But I wrote the film in my house, you know. I wrote the film looking out on the promenade, and I wrote the film for all the relationships, you know, all the dramatic relationships that actually existed in that town that you could see out of my window. So in that way, it's definitely a home movie.
Was this a town you thought of as dull when you were young?
Yeah, utterly dull, yeah, absolutely dull. Only kind of lightened by... You know, whatever badness you yourself could get up to, really.
So what is it that has drawn you back there now?
To make this movie? I felt the need to make a personal film. I felt the need to make a film that actually... that I myself wanted to see. I felt the need to make a film about emotional things that affected me. I also felt the need to make a film that was actually very gentle, in a way, in which nobody died, nobody blew up, nobody cut their throat, nobody... did any harm to anybody else other than the kind of damage that, I suppose, misplaced affection can do. And I felt the need to make the kind of film I myself would have liked to see in the cinema, really.
But you're living back in this town that you were anxious to get out of when you were young. Why are you living there now? What brought you back there to live?
Well, I'm Irish, and every Irish writer has a rather schizophrenic relationship with their homeland. You know, James Joyce kind of left it and reinvented it and never came back. But there wasn't plane flight in his day, you know. There wasn't... Boeing couldn't get you across the Atlantic in 5 hours. I find that I leave the place and I constantly return there. I mean, it's kind of, it's my roots in a way. It's a source of all kinds of different meaning for me. But to remain there forever and to live there forever would be like a sentence of death, I think. So I exist in this odd love-hate relationship with the place.
What do you miss and what are you glad to be away from as far as working with a big budget, you know, compared to the small budget that you've worked on for The Miracle?
Okay, when you do a big budget film, what you miss is the possibility of being irrational, being, I suppose you could call it whimsical, but doing things just because they please you. I mean, there are a lot of things as a director I want to do which perhaps don't advance the story or don't, maybe are difficult to explain and articulate, but they give me a tremendous amount of pleasure and I can't always explain why I want to do it this way. And on a big budget movie, you have to be explaining yourself all the time. You know, you have to be articulating that which should only be articulated through the movie itself. And that's what I missed when I was making large budget movies. What do I miss when I'm making small budget movies? I think I miss very little, really. I like the freedom that this kind of movie gives me. If I could get the same freedom with a larger budget, of course, I'd take it in a minute.
Now that you're back in Ireland, making small personal movies, is anyone making you feel like a failure?
Me feel like a failure?
Yeah, is anybody making you feel like a failure? Or implying that you're a failure because you left, even if it's just temporarily, Hollywood?
I don't think so, no. It's the opposite is the case. People don't like Hollywood, do they? Do you know, people don't like... They don't like writers or writer-directors to do the Hollywood movie. It's actually a thing that is rather frowned on over here, you know. It's not a matter of that, really. It's just a matter of... with me, it's a matter of always doing the film that, you know, is foremost on my mind, really.
Before you made movies, you wrote fiction. Are you writing fiction again now?
Yeah, I am. I'm writing a novel. Trying to write a novel. Trying to finish it. But I've been doing that for 4 years.
Oh.
Yeah.
Is it hard to write a novel after writing screenplays?
Well, it's the most difficult thing in the world, actually, because when you make a film and you write a screenplay, the great thing is there's pressure on you to finish it. Do you know what I mean? I write a screenplay, I give it out to my friends, to our distributors, our producers, or people like that. And suddenly you're making it, you know, so there's all this pressure that actually makes it happen. And to go from that to the world of just where the only responsibility is a page and yourself is a very disconcerting experience, you know. You realize how much noise there is in the world of movies, really, when you sit down at a page, try a piece of prose.
Do you write dialogue differently when you're writing fiction than when you're writing screenplays?
Well, I don't write dialogue when I'm writing fiction. I mean, the reason I stopped writing fiction was actually that most of the writing I was doing was almost entirely concerned with visual description. You know, my novels and my stories have very few lines of dialogue in them. And they were so obsessively concerned with visual description, it seemed almost pointless to continue to write them as novels. So I began making movies, you know what I mean? If you read my fiction, you'd find very few quotable lines, I think.
So it's still that way? Still very little dialogue?
Yeah, it is. It's almost the polar opposite of the movies that I make.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Neil Jordan's new film, The Miracle, will open in New York on July 3rd and will open wider on July 19th.
Three times, and whisper low, that you and I were sent by Joe. Then strike a match, and you will know you're in Hernando's Hideaway. Ooh-lay.
Don DeLillo's 1985 novel, White Noise, won a National Book Award. 4 years later, he won great critical acclaim for his novel, Libra, which was based on the story of Lee Harvey Oswald. DeLillo's new novel, his 10th work of fiction, is called Mao Two. Book critic John Leonard has a review.
After the decade of the 80s, in which all three of his novels amazed us, from Don DeLillo in the 90s, we expect transcendence. This, of course, is unfair. Not every DeLillo needs to be a knockout. Great Jones Street and Running Dog certainly weren't. But Mao too, so eagerly awaited, so full of lunar images, canny notions, and clever talk, fogs off. Maybe the problem is terrorism as a topic. Doris Lessing, Alberto Moravia, Mary McCarthy, Heinrich Böll, and Nadine Gordimer have all written foggy novels about it. not to mention Conrad and Malraux. DeLillo himself, the systems theorist of conspiracies, the humorist of dread, has been here before, in Players and the Names. Bill Gray in Mao 2 is one of DeLillo's men in small rooms. What's different about him is that he's also a novelist. Like Salinger and Pynchon and Salman Rushdie, Bill is hiding from the world. For 23 years, he's been working on a book he refuses to publish. He's come to suspect that books in the West have lost their power. Years ago, he says, I used to think it was possible for a novelist to alter the inner life of the culture. Now bomb makers and gunmen have taken that territory. They make raids on human consciousness, what writers used to do before we were all incorporated. Bill says this to the photographer Britta, whom he summoned to New England to take his picture. Britta, with her big city European sensibility, might have been a compelling character, but she's abandoned a third of the way into the novel until she's needed again at the end to go to Beirut. Karen, also, a former Mooney who hangs around the Gray household for sex and television, might have taken over as a heroine. She understands, from the frescoes on the TV screen, our rush to death, among the believers in Mexico City or Tehran, among the martyred in Tiananmen Square, among the homeless in New York. But Karen is without volition. She needs crowds to believe for her. She's lost in the dusty light of media catastrophe, the terror, we are told, that came blowing through the fog. Bill, implausibly, must leave New England for London, and London for Athens, and Athens for Beirut, to seek the release of a young Swiss poet held hostage by a terrorist faction nobody's ever heard of before. It's not just terrorists who've taken over. It's crowds, and the images of those crowds on television and in pop art, like silkscreen Andy Warhol's, a Maoist mass of victims, a genocide. And so the isolation of the artist, the isolation of the hostage, meets the 20th century mass mind, the 20th century collective death. A grand theme, no question. And along the way, we get some of the cerebral fireworks we've come to expect from DeLillo, the odd music of his eccentric spheres, his cantatas of the damned. But Bill Gray isn't up to the symbolic weight. When you inflict punishment on someone who is not guilty, he says, when you fill rooms with innocent victims, you begin to empty the world of meaning. A writer creates character as a way to reveal consciousness, increase the flow of meaning. This is how we reply to power and beat back our fear. By extending the pitch of consciousness and human possibility, this poet you've snatched, his detention drains the world of one more thimble of meaning. Well, I believe these words. It's Bill on his way to Beirut I don't believe, nor the Swiss poet, far too sketchily imagined, nor this novel, more willed than realized, a silk screen, a sculptured object, nerveless brain.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed Don DeLillo's new novel, Mao 2. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. When Mariah Nelson played professional women's basketball, she and her teammates were sent to charm school. Coming up, we talk with Nelson about some of the things women athletes are up against. Nelson is now a sports journalist and is the author of a new book about women athletes. And Elvis Costello has a new album. Our rock critic Ken Tucker tells us why he thinks it's a disappointment. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Russian President Boris Yeltsin was welcomed today to the White House by President Bush. The first ever elected Russian leader is on a four-day visit to the United States, and he was told by Mr. Bush that the U.S. intends to maintain close ties with Soviet President Gorbachev. NPR's Brian Naylor has more on the story.
The Bush administration has maintained all along that while it was glad for the burgeoning democratic movement in the Russian Republic, it is Mikhail Gorbachev they plan to deal with. And if Boris Yeltsin had any doubts about the strength of the White House commitment to Gorbachev, they were surely put aside today by President Bush.
Let's not forget that it was President Gorbachev's courageous policies of glasnost and perestroika that were the pivotal factors enabling us to end the Cold War and make Europe whole and free.
Mr. Bush told Yeltsin the U.S. intends to have good relations with both the Soviet government and the Russian Republic. This is Brian Naylor in Washington.
German lawmakers have voted to transfer the seat of government to Berlin from Bonn. The vote was 337 to 320 to make the move from Bonn, which has been the capital since the end of World War II. Under the plan, only Parliament's upper house will stay in Bonn. Germans have argued for weeks over the future site of Germany's government, and supporters of the move argued that Berlin is a symbol of a more integrated Europe. Bonn supporters indicated concern that Berlin would become too powerful if it became the seat of government and that Bonn would suffer financially. On Capitol Hill, the Senate has begun debate on controversial anti-crime legislation. This debate is likely to last several weeks as senators decide whether to endorse provisions, ranging from a ban on semi-automatic weapons to the wide application of the federal death penalty. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold has more.
The Senate is considering two bills, a Republican-backed measure which is heavy on reforms to the criminal justice system, and legislation sponsored by Judiciary Chairman Joseph Biden, which includes several gun control provisions. Both bills have been criticized as looking tough, but actually doing little to affect crime on the streets. Ohio Senator Howard Metzenbaum.
Mr. President, who's the toughest kid on the block? Oh, I got a tougher bill than you got. Oh, no, we Republicans got a tougher bill than the Democrats have got. We're going to all solve the problems about crime. Let's quit kidding ourselves.
A 7-day waiting period for the purchase of handguns, which passed the House last month, and a ban on 14 types of semi-automatic weapons are included in the Biden bill. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down 1.5 points to close at 2,953.94, volume 163 million shares. This is NPR News. Secretary of State James Baker says that there are still three major issues holding up completion of an arms control treaty. President Bush has made completion of this treaty, which has been a subject of ongoing talks for 9 years, a condition for a summit meeting with Soviet leader Gorbachev. After talks in Berlin today with the Soviet foreign minister, Baker said things are right where they were as far as a summit goes. Baker says the last remaining problems in a treaty involves types of missiles allowed, how warheads taken from certain missiles would be counted, and how information would be shared from missile flight test. The Greek government has imposed emergency measures in Athens, hoping to ease the deadly smog that has ranked the capital among the most polluted cities in the world. Tasia Kavadias reports from Athens.
Over 1,000 people were hospitalized over 2 days when pollution in the air exceeded danger levels. Today, hundreds of motorists abandoned their cars in the city's outskirts when police barricades blocked entry of vehicles carrying less than 4 passengers. The dark gray cloud that envelops the Acropolis is known as Nephos. In recent years, it, along with record heat waves, have made life unbearable for Athenians and prompted the EEC to issue strict warnings to Greece to clean up its act. The Greek government is warning the elderly and those with respiratory ailments to stay indoors and avoid even daily activity. Officials today admitted pollution levels are expected to set new records tomorrow. For National Public Radio, I'm Tasia Cavadias in Athens.
A new labor center has been opened in Warsaw by U.S. and Polish officials. The center will train construction workers in modern techniques to help build low-cost housing. The Labor Department is giving $500,000 for the center, and the AFL-CIO is sending instructors. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Sports changed for women in 1972 with the passage of an amendment to the Civil Rights Bill known as Title IX. That amendment outlawed discrimination based on sex in schools receiving federal money. So girls and women's sports programs in schools and colleges expanded. One of the young women who joined a college team in the early 70s was my guest Mariah Burton Nelson. She played center on the women's basketball team at Stanford and went on to play professionally. She's now a sports writer and has written a book about women athletes called Are We Winning Yet? Through the athletes she profiles, Nelson examines the state of women's sports in America. I asked her about playing college ball during a transitional period for women.
Well, my first 2 years at Stanford, we wore little red shorts and white blouses with red pennies over them.
What's a penny?
A penny is a cloth sort of vest that girls used to wear instead of going shirts and skins to differentiate one team from the other. In other words, we didn't have uniforms. We played in the small, what was called the women's gym. It was the old men's gym, and the men played in the new 8,000-seat arena called Maples Pavilion. We didn't travel very much. We had a coach who was just a part-time graduate student who was volunteering her time. My second 2 years at Stanford, we finally got 2 full-time, very qualified coaches. We began to play in what had been called the men's gym. We began to travel more, and finally we got real uniforms. So I was sort of on that cusp between old-time women's sports and this new wave of new opportunity for women.
I think one of the things that changed in that new wave was that there were more male coaches for women's basketball.
Yes, I began to see that influx of male coaches, and I began to see some of the women adopt a male sort of style of coaching where they would yell at players until the players were in tears, using humiliation or threats as a way to motivate. I saw players, myself included, play through injury, not only through pain, but through injury, often making injuries worse in pursuit of victory. So while at the same time that we got a lot more opportunity, we started to suffer from some of the problems of men's sports as well.
What kind of attitude did you get from your fellow college students, male and female, when you were playing basketball?
Well, it was not a prestigious thing to do at Stanford. We had very small crowds. I think I was typecast as a jock. I was probably assumed to be a lesbian, which in my case was true, but that's something that is used to keep all women out of sport and to discourage women from going into sports. So even though I loved it, I had a terrific time. I enjoyed the process of learning about my body. I became strong. I loved the women I played with. It was a good opportunity, but it wasn't about fans and fame.
After college, you played with what you've described as the misguided and short-lived Women's Pro Basketball League. How was it misguided?
Well, it was run entirely by men. There were all male owners and coaches, and they didn't understand women. One man specifically told me, "This is not a women's lib thing." When one of my teammates had asked to be called women rather than girls. We were young women in our early 20s, right out of college, and it was the height or one of the heights of the feminist movement, and it was important to us as young women to be called women instead of girls. And he denied that request. We were sent to charm school on one team I played for as a way to deter people from calling us lesbians, basically, since that is a label that has always chased women athletes around the playing fields, as if to put on makeup or to learn how to dress in a traditional feminine manner proves that you're not gay. So I was insulted by a lot of those sort of things. There was another team that had mandatory makeup sessions before each home game.
What was the logic behind that?
Well, again, to sort of prove our femininity, as if playing basketball wasn't a feminine thing to do.
When you were playing pro basketball, were there big crowds for that?
Not in the United States. I did play in Europe for a year, and we drew crowds of up to 3,000 to 5,000. So for that time, late 70s, early 80s, that was considered pretty big. But by today's standards, no, they weren't big crowds either.
Is there more interest now in watching women's sports than there was when you were playing?
Well, there is. There's a lot more interest. Still, there isn't a successful women's pro league of basketball here in this country, but the tennis circuit, of course, draws big crowds. And the same excuse that's used to keep women out of professional basketball has been disproven by the success of tennis, which is that women's basketball will never draw the crowds because they can't dunk and because they aren't as good as the men and they'll always be compared to the men. But when you look at women's tennis now, it is a different game. The top women cannot compete on an equal basis with the top men, and yet they do draw crowds. It is a very exciting game to watch. In fact, some people prefer watching women's tennis.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Mariah Burton Nelson. She's an athlete and sports journalist and author of the new book, Are We Winning Yet? How Women Are Changing Sports and Sports Are Changing Women. We'll take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Athlete and sports journalist Mariah Burton Nelson is my guest. So you gave up basketball because of knee injuries, right?
Well, that was part of it. Also, the sexism and homophobia of the league was very difficult for me to handle. So it was a combination of factors. The league folded shortly after I left. It was a very disappointing experience overall, which is why I'm not thrilled when they talk about starting up another pro league, again with all male owners and all male coaches, and putting the women in skin-tight unitards, which is what they're planning to do, to again sort of feminize and sexualize the women.
Were you out when you were playing in the league?
Well, I was generally out, but when I had a conversation with one of my coaches in which he told me that our uniforms were made by faggots, I thought, well, this is not a man to come out to. So I was not open with him, nor was I open with my teammates, but I did go to Gay Pride Day in San Francisco, where I was playing at the time with 200,000 other people in, as I said, the late 70s or early 80s, and I was spotted there by a news reporter from a television station who had earlier interviewed me, and he told the coach, and that did lead to my being traded.
So you mean this reporter basically outed you?
Yes.
Did you ever talk to the reporter about it?
No, I didn't. You know, it was a funny sort of thing. I thought I saw him. Our eyes met, and I sort of saw my career flash before my eyes, knowing how homophobic my coach was. And yet I thought, well, what are my choices? Can I call this guy up tonight after the parade and say, even though I feel proud and happy and open enough to show up at the parade or the march, I would like you not to tell somebody I was there? You know, it was too much of a contradiction. So I didn't talk to him, but I did hear later that was, in fact, why I was traded. I was told I was traded because I wasn't tall enough, and there was nobody taller than me on the whole team.
So. I just want to clarify, did this reporter call your coach just to tell your coach that you were there, or did the reporter mention your name in an article that the coach read?
He did not print it. He directly told the coach. The papers at the time wanted to pick it up, and I asked them not to because I still was interested in playing professional basketball here in the United States after playing for a year in Europe. So I wanted to be picked up by other teams and knew that I would be essentially blacklisted if I were openly gay, although, of course, there are gay women throughout sports, as there are gay men throughout sports. But it's being openly gay that really gives the owners a hard time.
Is this an issue that kept coming up with many of the women who you've interviewed over the years about sports?
Yes, it is. And what was interesting to me in writing Are We Winning Yet was that even the straight women brought it up. Jackie Joyner Kersee told me that she has been called a lesbian, even though she's married.
It's just a cover.
I think not in her case, but perhaps so in some cases. There are extremes that women will go to show that they're not gay because it is such a scary label and, in fact, can have a very deleterious effect on one's career. But what she said was, it's something they do to keep women out of sports. That's all it is. And I think she's right. You know, they used to say that it would damage our uterus if we played sports and we wouldn't be able to have babies. And then we pointed out that we don't need jock straps. We are actually much better protected biologically from sports injuries. And then they said that we didn't have the endurance to run a marathon or to do the distances. And then we sort of waved at the men as we passed them in the marathon. So we've disproven all the other excuses to keep women out of sports. And this is one that is still has some power. You know, your daughter will turn gay somehow if she plays sports. People are still afraid of it.
I think athletes are always worried that when they retire from professional sports that their bodies are going to change a lot. Did that happen to you?
It did happen. I had deliberately gained about 20 pounds. I'm naturally thin, and I gained weight in order to be a big, strong center. As a center in basketball, you have to stand your ground, you have to push people around, you have to not let them push you. And it was muscle mass, and I was very proud of my big thighs that were like tree trunks. I naturally lost that weight, and though being thin is generally revered in this culture, it took me a while to get used to being thinner and not being so muscle-bound. I don't parade myself in quite the same way, trying to show off my strength. So in that way, it's been a good thing.
I want to ask you about some of the common frustrations of women athletes that you've interviewed. I think one that really keeps coming up in reading your book is that a lot of sponsors want to make sure that women look attractive. How does this affect women athletes?
One of the women I talked with was Paula Newby Fraser, who has won the Ironman triathlon 3 times. That's that grueling, long triple race in Hawaii where first you swim 2.2 miles in the ocean, and then you ride 110 miles on a bike, and then you run a full 26-mile marathon. And she told me that even while she's running and swimming and biking that long distance, it takes about 9 hours, she is concerned about what she looks like. It's not a judged sport like gymnastics or skating where you're actually judged on what you look like. All that matters is when you cross the finish line. And yet because she's a woman, she receives pressure from her sponsors to do her hair a certain way, to wear a bikini rather than a one-piece suit. She says even among the women, there's a certain sort of meta competition in which the women compete with each other to be as thin as possible.
The pieces that are collected in your new book, Are We Winning Yet?, are mostly profiles of women athletes. And it's mostly women involved in non-team sports?
Yes.
Are you interested at all in covering, you know, like the big-ticket sports, men's professional basketball, football, baseball, that kind of stuff?
No, I don't do that kind of writing as a sports writer. I focus on women and on co-ed sports. I think there's plenty of attention going to football. I don't need to add my voice on that subject. I'm more interested in who women are and how women are changing the nature of sport and the opportunities women are getting these days. But yes, a lot of the sports in the book are co-ed sports because you can't talk about women athletes anymore without talking about men as well. So many of our coaches are male. Husbands and brothers and fathers are putting in their 2 cents, sometimes to our detriment and sometimes in a very helpful way. So it became a book about how women are competing now that we've moved out of the segregated women's gym and into the larger domain of sport.
Well, Mariah, thank you very much for talking with us.
It's good to be here.
My guest has been Mariah Burton Nelson. She's an athlete and sports journalist and author of the new book, Are We Winning Yet? How Women Are Changing Sports and Sports Are Changing Women. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. Several rulings in the Supreme Court today, and one about a question of libel. A scholar, Jeffrey Mason, sued The New Yorker and the writer Janet Malcolm, saying she made up some quotations about him. The Supreme Court says the lower court should reconsider having a jury trial in this matter. Ina Jaffe reports from California on the future of water rights there, the conflict between city people, farmers, and environmentalists. NPR's John Burnett reports from Kuwait City on the trial of those suspected of collaboration with the Iraqi forces during the occupation, and letters from listeners about politically correct language and a gay and lesbian travel guide.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Rocker Elvis Costello is on tour now, and he's just released a new album, his first in 2 years. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of Mighty Like a Rose.
The sun struggles up another beautiful day, and I felt glad in my own suspicious way.
Elvis Costello is the most prolific first-rate rock act since the Beatles. Want to argue about that? I dare you to come up with any performer over the past two decades who's put out more music of such consistent invention and passion. All of which makes Mighty Like a Rose especially notable. It's probably Costello's lamest album, at least since the mechanical Punch the Clock in 1983. Mighty Like a Rose is the most overwrought record Costello has ever released, and the first time in which he sounds as if he's straining for the fancy verbal effects that he usually seems to toss off with ease.
I looked on but hesitated. I failed to interrupt. You're so hard to tell the truth to, so easy to corrupt. I memorize your face. Your tragic smile, hurt look in your eyes, as you betrayed yourself to the part of him that dies. The waiting lines are long, they never get too far. The shining of their shoes to kick a falling star. You think you should be somebody, but you don't.
Like a lot of songs on Mighty Like a Rose, Harpy's Bazaar features a fussy melody and lyrics that have few ideas and no emotions at stake. It's just another story about a vaguely described couple having trouble with their relationship. When Costello doesn't have a point to make, he tends to use his verbal gifts to make ringing, hollow statements that, upon a moment's thought, really don't mean anything. The waiting lines are long, he says in the final verse. They never get too far. They're shining up their shoes to kick a falling star. You think you should be somebody, but you don't know who you are. Well, neither do you this time out, Elvis. Another song, Georgie and Her Rival, does something I've never heard Costello do before. He steals from himself. The melody here is a pretty obvious lift from his great 10-year-old song, Oliver's Army.
Georgie, good to hate her.
Derivative and sentimental Georgie and Her Rival isn't much, but it is one of the few songs on Mighty Like a Rose that employs Costello's voice in an effective way. Harsh and raspy, it's always been, I'm convinced, the primary reason that this brilliant pop artist has never had a big hit, and its limitations only become more evident when he tries to croon soulfully. The best slow tempo number on this album, Broken, uses Costello's voice as a kind of malevolent moan. Broken was written by Kate O'Riordan, to whom Costello dedicates the album and refers to in the liner notes as my unspeakable wife.
If I am frightened, then I can hide it. If I am crying, I'll call it laughter. If I am haunted,
call it my imaginary friend. If I am bleeding, I'll call it wine. But if you leave me, then I am broken. And if I'm broken,
Mighty Like a Rose also contains two songs left over from Costello's collaboration with Paul McCartney from a couple of years ago. They aren't, however, leftovers. So Like Candy is a fully felt ballad, while Playboy to a Man is a big, noisy piece of music, a well-made mess that this meticulously self-conscious album could use more of.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly.
Fresh Air's reviews and interviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Salad, and Naomi Person, with Joan Tuohy, Roberta Shurrock, and Sue Weinstein. We'd like to welcome the listeners of KMBH in Harlingen and Brownsville, Texas. KMBH started broadcasting Fresh Air this month. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs. 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk to the great soul and gospel singer, Al Green. I'm Terry Gross. Join us.